In the news.
Welcome, I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. Welcome to In the News for American and Texas Government.
Another quiet week.
Yes.
Nothing going on. Nothing going on. Sorry, folks.
Yeah, just a few things. So again, a bunch of liberals got together in Philly, and they, dropped a bunch of balloons in the end.
I love the balloon drop.
Yes.
I'm very pro balloon drop.
Yeah, but the problem is the balloons have been getting, if you notice, the balloons have been getting bigger over the decades.
I also am not really crazy about really old men, like, popping the balloons and stuff. Like, watching Bill Clinton up there, I was just hoping nothing went wrong, because it seemed like it was on dangerous ground there for a while.
But everybody looks amazed with the balloons. Like, they revert to a child. But again, the balloons, because someone was talking about Hillary Clinton freaking out over one of the balloons. Those balloons are getting bigger each year. So if like it was a regular little balloon, I'd be okay. But I mean, they're getting to be about the the size of a small SUV. So you got to watch where you're going.
Well, the balloon, the contrast with the balloons, this is a sure an inappropriate statement at some level. But for a long time, Hillary was wearing this blueberry blue pantsuit, and she looked like Violet Beauregard from Willy Wonka. And I kept expecting her at some point during the campaign season to just sort of expand into a blueberry. Well, she stopped wearing that suit, which is a good thing, because I think she could have been mistaken for a balloon.
Yeah,
it's amazing. On the stage, had she gone there, but she went with a tasteful pantsuit.
Oh yeah, and again, my whole thing was everybody's like, she's getting freaked out about the balloons. They're humongous. It's one of the worst things in the world is to accept the presidential nomination, then get a concussion from a balloon. So
it's one of the worst.
Well, one of the worst.
Top five.
Yeah, top five. But again, as this campaign has shown us, we hit new lows every day. But let's actually talk about the substantive aspect of the DNC convention. So the DNC met in Philadelphia. We spoke a little bit last week about the attempts to kind of curtail the anger of the Bernie supporters and try to bring about party unity. And you saw some of that coming about. But again, dealing with the email scandal is a little bit of a difficult hurdle to overcome. Something about Hillary Clinton emails just don't go well together. There's always a scandal. But there were some key things that were said. And again, you see really a lot of talking about unity amongst the party, but actually going after Trump and his credibility. This is the great thing about going second, is that you can basically pick and get a chance to pick apart what everybody else said.
You can counterpunch.
Yeah.
You can counterpunch.
And that's exactly what was going on. But we also see coming out of this is President Obama's really last major national address to the public, at least in terms of a speech. Let's hear some of the clips from that.
What we heard in Cleveland last week wasn't particularly Republican. And it sure wasn't conservative. What we heard was a deeply pessimistic vision of a country where we turn against each other and turn away from the rest of the world. There were no serious solutions to pressing problems, just the fanning of resentment and blame and anger and hate. And that is not the America I know. You know, nothing truly prepares you for the demands of the Oval Office. You can read about it, you can study it, but until you've sat at that desk, you don't know what it's like to manage a global crisis or send young people to war. But Hillary's been in the room. She's been part of those decisions. She knows what's at stake in the decisions our government makes. What's at stake for the working family, for the senior citizen, or the small business owner, for the soldier, for the veteran. And even in the midst of crisis, she listens to people and she keeps her cool and she treats everybody with respect. And no matter how daunting the odds, no matter how much people try to knock her down, she never, ever quits. That is the Hillary I know. That's the Hillary I've come to admire. And that's why I can say with confidence, there has never been a man or a woman, not me, not Bill, nobody more qualified than Hillary Clinton to serve as President of the United States of America.
Well, I guess leading the Allies in World War II against the Axis powers doesn't qualify Dwight Eisenhower more than Hillary Clinton. But, sort of possible partisan hyperbole aside, there you see the president on the Wednesday night of the Democratic Convention, Wednesday night, giving, I think by all accounts, a very effective defense of his policies about what the administration has done, setting the tone. Basically, you know, as Professor McDaniel and I are talking about, counterpunching. Republicans want to say things are really bad, things are in tough shape. No, I think, this is Obama, you know, no, the country is sort of fundamentally solid, tapping into the optimism that most political consultants will tell you is necessary to effectively campaign for president. So that's the contrast, right? They're doomsayers, doom and gloom. We are the party of optimism. And so this is, in some sense, for those of you with a sense of history, kind of an interesting, you know, historical flip-flop. Usually it's the Republicans who get out there and talk about, especially in the days of Reagan. You know, Clinton did this a little bit too, but we always think of Morning in America as the advertising campaign associated with Ronald Reagan and the Republicans in the 1980s. Well, the Democrats kind of stole that page out of the Republican playbook this time around, effectively contrasting Hillary as the candidate of optimism and forward-looking progress and this sort of thing. So that was Obama's task. Now, Obama kind of set her up saying she's the heir to the throne. Right? You know, she's going to continue my legacy. She's uniquely positioned. She's uniquely qualified. Right? I actually think when you start talking about whether the country's doing well or not well, I'm not sure that debate has any real clear resolution right now. A lot of people who agree with the Trump vision, a lot of people agree with the Obama vision. But the thing that I think was really effective there is playing up the notion of qualifications, because lots of people, 60% to even as high as 2/3 of Americans, do not think Donald Trump is qualified to be president, lacks the temperament, lacks the knowledge. So hitting on that and saying that's the contrast y'all ought to be concerned with, I think was a very effective thing that President Obama did in that speech. So, you know, I don't want to get too wrapped up. These speeches, too wrapped up in the particular speeches. I think, you know, we got all excited about Michelle Obama's speech and President Obama's speech. I don't know that those things singularly do a whole lot. I don't even know that Hillary Clinton's speech, which we'll get to in just a sec, does a whole lot. But, you know, collectively they create kind of an agenda and, a theme for the fall campaign. And I think what you've seen right now is the Republicans have tossed out a theme that says things are going to hell in a handbasket. We need radical change. Not quite sure what that looks like exactly, but radical change. Although I think it's got orange hair. On the Democratic side, it's sort of stay the course, steady hand. Things aren't that bad. We really need kind of qualified, you know, experienced leadership right now. And that's the contrast, right? So we'll see what Americans think of this. Then we've got Hillary Clinton's speech. So let's kind of wrap up our convention coverage here with a little excerpt from Hillary Clinton's acceptance speech, first female to win a major party nomination.
It is with humility, determination, and boundless confidence in America's promise that I accept your nomination for President of the United States.
The former Secretary of State, Senator, and First Lady spent nearly an hour last night laying out her vision for the future.
Clinton said the country is at a moment of reckoning, and she urged all Americans to work together to meet the challenges to come.
Nancy Cordes is at Temple University in Philadelphia, where Clinton and running mate Tim Kaine will appear in just a few hours from now. Nancy, good morning.
Good morning. This was a speech for the record books in more ways than one. The first time in modern history that a nominee argued her opponent was simply incapable of doing the job. But Clinton also acknowledged that many Americans still don't know quite what to make of her, despite her decades in public life.
Tonight, we've reached a milestone in our nation's march toward a more perfect union. The first time that a major party has nominated a woman for president.
It was a history-making moment, and Clinton savored it.
When there are no ceilings, the sky's the limit.
Clinton used the biggest speech of her life to try to explain what makes her tick.
I sweat the details of policy, whether we're talking about the exact level of lead in the drinking water in Flint, Michigan. It's not just a detail if it's your kid, if it's your family. It's a big deal.
She said it is not a big deal to her opponent.
You didn't hear any of this, did you, from Donald Trump at his convention? He spoke for 70-odd minutes, and I do mean odd.
Again and again, she laid into Trump's character.
He loses his cool at the slightest provocation. A man you can bait with a tweet is not a man we can trust with nuclear weapons. Donald Trump says, and this is a quote, "I know more about ISIS than the generals do." No, Donald, you don't.
Clinton spent the most time on the economy, an issue where our poll shows Trump has the biggest edge.
Democrats, we are the party of working people. My primary mission as president will be to create more opportunity and more good jobs with rising wages.
And she said his rhetoric,
"I alone can fix it,"
should alarm everyone.
Really? I alone can fix it? He's betting that the perils of today's world will blind us to its unlimited promise. He's taken the Republican Party a long way, from morning in America to midnight in America.
Well, there you have it. It is historic. I mean, you know, as I said, in the history of modern political, that's not, it's, you know, the first major political party nominee in the United States. Obviously, we've got, you know, Angela Merkel in Germany. Actually, someone pointed out the other day that you could, by January, have female leaders in the top executive positions in the United States, Great Britain, and Germany, which would be, of course, unprecedented. So for those of you who are down for the movement, you know, there you go.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, we've had female vice presidential candidates, so Geraldine Ferraro, Sarah Palin, but the idea of being the person who's on the top of the ticket is a historic moment. And I think one of the things about it is, while there was a great deal of attention paid to Obama being the first African-American to be a presidential candidate for a major party, I think a lot has been lost in really the significant moment of what's going on with Hillary Clinton. And so I think maybe it's because she's been around for so long.
I think it's a big part of it.
Yeah, yeah. But then also because there's some controversy associated with her, whereas Obama's, you know, was it Harry Reid who said he's clean. he didn't have many controversies behind him. And so because of that, it doesn't seem, his seemed to be much more of a clean, ascension, whereas Hillary Clinton appears to be much more, jacktooth in that sense, where there's a lot of controversies, a lot of weird things going on. But we've reached this historic moment. And I think, you know, it's something we should, you know, whether partisan or not, should take time to acknowledge that we are, in many ways, are expanding the field of people that we see as worthy of leading the U.S. So if you think of Kennedy with opening the door to Catholics, if you think of Obama with African Americans, Romney with Mormons, now with Hillary Clinton, you see this with women, that in terms of leadership, we are expanding the number of people we can see as leaders of the nation.
You even look at the Republican primary contest, and for all the, you know, kind of scorn that was heaped upon the 17 candidates, I think at its apex, 17 candidates were involved. But you think about the Republican primaries, and you had, Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, Cuban-Americans running for president. You had Carly Fiorina, female, running for president. Ben Carson, African-American, running for president. You know, it's even on the Republican side, and the Republican coalition, as we've talked about in lecture modules, is not as diverse as the Democratic coalition. It's just not. Historically, the groups that animate the Republican voting public aren't as racially, ethnically diverse as the Democrats' coalition. But even on the Republican side, all sorts of, you know, in the case of Cruz and Rubio and Fiorina, these are credentialed people who ran for president. I think you could say Carson perhaps less so, but, you know, the fact that he's running and the fact that he drew a sizable portion of the vote from social conservatives was, I think, meaningful. So Professor McDaniel's point, I think, you know, is an important one. And we kind of take it for granted these days, you know, female senators running. In Texas, of course, we have a history. We've had female executives, female governors. We've had a female senator, Kay Bailey Hutchison. You know, so it's maybe less exotic at the state level, but I don't know. I mean, I have sort of mixed feelings, I think, like almost every American about Hillary Clinton, but I thought it was a really kind of impressive moment when you actually see her up there accepting the nomination. You almost forget she's Hillary for a moment, and that's kind of hard to do, I think. You know, so we have a fresh batch of polls that have come out in the wake. So we have these two conventions back to back. So Professor McDaniel, I can say a couple of things now about what we think the result of these conventions has been. And so you take a look. This is a trend line that takes these data points that you're looking at on the slide right now are all of the, I think, credentialed or, you know, kind of professionally legitimate. It's probably a little loaded phrase. Public opinion polls that have occurred over the past 6 to 8 months. And the trend line, the red dots show particular point estimates of Donald Trump standing in a trial ballot matchup with Hillary Clinton. That is, a poll asks, if the election were held today, would you vote for Donald Trump, the Republican, or Hillary Clinton, the Democrat? So the red represents point estimates of Trump's support. The blue dots represent estimates of Hillary Clinton's support. The trend line shows what's happened over time. And you see at the beginning of the time series, a fairly significant, sort of a massive lead for Hillary Clinton. So this is national polling results. As you all know, we don't actually have a national popular vote in the United States. But it is very indicative of overall support, as we'll get to in a second when we show the Electoral College breakdown. So you see that significant lead narrowed considerably as Trump, you know, marched to victories and, you know, closed to about, you know, 5 points or so. And it bumped along, and Hillary, as you see, you move across from left to right, Hillary opened up a fairly significant lead over Trump, you know, on the order of double digits as you move through the spring. That lead began to narrow. And, you know, Trump seemed to close the gap. You all see then it opened up a little bit, you know, as Trump faced some controversies at the beginning of the summer. And then you see an uptick in the red and a downtick in the blue. That represents basically Trump's convention bounce, right? You see, he closed it to just a point or two, but then at the very end, and that's what we want to draw your attention to, the newest polling information suggests that Hillary Clinton got at least as significant a bump as Trump did out of her convention, probably more significant. How significant? I think you're seeing some polls coming out right now that show the race between 6 to 10 points in favor of Hillary Clinton. So she seems to have opened up a fairly significant national lead. Was that expected? No, not really. I mean, there was a sense that it would be difficult for Clinton to move the dial much because she's so well known. You know, it's difficult for candidates who have a long history to convince voters to take a fresh look or to move to them from some candidate who's typically kind of new and fresh like Donald Trump is, whatever else you want to say about him. Well, new and fresh might not be the right words, but, you know, different at least. But right now, if you're asking us where the race is, you know, I'd kind of split the difference in this 6 to 10 margin and say it's probably an 8 or 9 point Clinton lead. And I think the Donald's in serious trouble. There are examples of candidates overcoming that sort of deficit in the course of American presidential history, but there are not a lot of them. And, you know, if the events of the last couple of days are any indication, he doesn't seem to be on task to doing the sorts of things he needs to do to, you know, move that race back to within a 2 or 3 point margin. If you're within 2 or 3 points, then hey, anything can happen. But if you're down 8 or 9, you got some serious problems.
For instance, you don't pick fights with babies.
Yeah, I think that's probably not the smartest thing. Now, we could also take a look, as we've explained a few times in the modules, and we really want to kind of focus your attention on this. Presidential elections are not won in the popular vote. The popular vote, here's the thing that happens. Students learn, you know, you all probably knew this intellectually, but when you take a class like this, it's reinforced. Hey, there's a thing called the Electoral College that actually decides presidential races. So then, you know, those of you who are out there really attentive and smart will say, like, I don't even care about the national polls don't mean anything. Okay. Yeah, they do, because states add up to national votes. So the notion that Hillary Clinton, for instance, would move the dial nationally, and it wouldn't be manifest in a change in kind of how certain states are leaning, it's probably nonsense. So while it's true we want your attention to be on the state-by-state races because that's where you amass a sufficient number of electoral votes to win the presidency, don't ignore the national numbers. I mean, what'll happen is these numbers that we've seen moving in the national polls will now start to get state-by-state polls that probably corroborate that story at a more localized level. So the bump up that Hillary got in the national polls is almost certainly going to be manifest in polls in states like Ohio and Pennsylvania and Florida, which haven't been done yet. It takes a little while to organizations to get the resources together and run state polls. So Professor McDaniel and I have cobbled something together. I'm actually involved in the Fox News decision team, the national decision team, and we've got something we call the electoral scorecard. I've put up the latest version of the electoral scorecard up here, right, which shows you, and I think this probably reflects, and Professor McDaniel and I will talk about this here, probably reflects our best guess about the way things are right now as you look across the nation. So we got five categories here for you. The deep red are states that are pretty solid for Trump. The kind of shaded red, those are states that are leaning Trump, but could be in play. So there you see states like Arizona, Missouri, Georgia. These are traditionally states that go Republican, but Hillary Clinton's campaign is targeting them, right? In Georgia, a lot of African-American voters who are, you know, newly registered could bring that state into competitive status. Arizona, lots of Hispanic voters, a younger population, they're getting on the rolls now. They could make that state more competitive. Missouri, home state to Professor McDaniel. Well, in a way, I right? Got that St. Louis connection.
Yeah.
Right. That's a state that used to be a real battleground, has moved towards the Republicans, but you get a flawed candidate, Missouri becomes, you know, bellwether again, right? Now, the gold states here, I should also put it on the other side, dark blue are the Democratic base states. So those are the states that Hillary is almost certain to win. You see the Pacific Coast, Washington to California. You see the upper New England states, Maine, New York, Vermont, all the New England states, Connecticut, Massachusetts, et cetera, heavily for Clinton, Illinois, Hillary's nominal home state, Minnesota, right? And then the shaded blue, those are states that are leaning Clinton, Michigan, Wisconsin, a couple others, right? So, and we've got there on the key how those add up in terms of electoral college votes. All right, but the gold states are where this election is almost certainly going to be decided. And we've got Nevada, Colorado, Iowa, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, the sole battleground state in the New England area. We've got the Atlantic Coast states, North Carolina, Virginia, and Florida. Now, if I were, this was done, I think, late June, right? So this thing's got a little moss on it. How would I change it right now? I would move Colorado to lean Democratic. I think Hillary's got about an 8 to 10 point lead there. I've heard she's pulled her television advertising from Colorado, which suggests to me they think it's safe for her, right? So I would move Colorado. The other states, I think, are probably pretty appropriately classified. I still think Florida, Ohio. I wouldn't quite put Virginia in the lean Clinton right now, but I'd be tempted to. I'd be tempted to, right? And I think the states that we had leaning, you know, about a month ago, Arizona, Missouri, and Georgia, I see no reason. I do not believe that Trump locked those states up with his convention. I think those states are still in play. I think you're going to see Hillary advertising in Phoenix, in Atlanta, and St. Louis, maybe even Kansas City in the next few weeks. Little side note, last night I saw Hillary Clinton went to Omaha, Nebraska. And you're looking at the map right now, you're saying, you know, Nebraska has not gone Democratic since Franklin Roosevelt ran. Why would she be in Nebraska? Nebraska is one of two states, along with Maine, that allocates its electors by congressional district results. Every other state's a winner-take-all. If you win Texas, you get all of Texas's electoral votes. But Nebraska does it a little different. If you win the state, you get two electoral votes for winning the state. But there's three other electoral votes associated with Nebraska. Those electors are determined by the voting results in each of the congressional districts. So they do it a funky way. So getting back, why was Hillary in Omaha? Because Omaha is Congressional District 2. Omaha is the only congressional district in Nebraska that's competitive. Hillary Clinton could go in there and win Omaha and take an electoral vote out of Nebraska. Obama did that in 2008. I think Hillary's looking to steal an electoral vote, however she can. I shouldn't say steal. We're not supposed to say steal. Win. Strategically claim, be a better phrase, right? You add all this up, by the way, 270 is the magic number. Got to get 270 electoral votes to win a majority. 538 total votes. Think about that, right? Go back. 435 representatives, 100 senators. 435 plus 100 is 535. But I said 538, you say. Is Professor Shaw's math wrong? Well, probably. But there's an extra three. For purposes of presidential elections, we treat the District of Columbia as a state. That's 538. 50% of 538, a majority is 270. So what you're talking about in a presidential election is amassing electoral votes to get to 270. Who's got the edge right now? Hillary Clinton clearly has the edge. We've got her right around the 220 vote range. I think McDaniel and I both agree on that. What does that mean? That means if she wins Florida, she's almost there. All she needs is like one or two other states. So Trump has to win Florida. I would argue the interesting thing right now is that Trump not only has to win Florida, I think he has to win Ohio and Pennsylvania. Those three states. If you tune in on election night in November and you see the early returns from Pennsylvania showing a Clinton lead, if the networks call Clinton in Pennsylvania fairly early on, I think this race is done. I think he's put himself in a box where he's got to win Pennsylvania. Otherwise, he's in trouble. So those three states are the ones out of this grouping that I would really highlight. So what do you think?
No, I mean, this is an interesting case. Looking at the national polls does tell you something, but looking more at the state polls and seeing what the Electoral College, how it'll shake out in Electoral College is really interesting as well. So when people are talking about the, I think this is a more nuanced discussion of this. A lot of people have already tried to decide which states are going which way. And so there are a lot of predictions that Clinton should win handily, but you actually see that, it's a little bit more nuanced than that. And there's a lot up for grabs. And really, Florida really seems to be the state that's always up for grabs. California consistently goes for the Democratic Party. Texas consistently goes for the Republican Party. And these are large states, a lot of electoral college votes. Florida, basically since 2000, everybody's been focused on Florida. So either what Florida is doing right or what Florida is doing wrong in terms of its elections. It's been criticized for long lines, things of that nature. And the reason why there's so much attention paid to Florida, because Florida has so many electoral college votes. And so it's important to pay attention to which states have the most electoral college votes. It's not the number of states you win, it's the number of states with large electoral electoral college vote numbers that are important here. So this is an important strategy to understand of why they're campaigning in certain states and not campaigning in others. Some, this is really, you're going to win it or you're going to lose it no matter how much you do. But there are some that, it's worth so much that you go in and take the risk.
Yeah, I think there's an interesting article in the Washington Post earlier this week basically saying that Clinton's math is so much easier than Trump's. And that, as Professor McDaniel intimated, that she's just got this thing kind of wired. And then there was a follow-up article, Chris Saliza, who writes The Fix, which is sort of this interesting blog on the Washington Post website. And he raised his point. He said, look, it is true she starts off with an advantage, but Trump has a path to the White House. Some of you may not like to hear that, but he's got a path. The path runs through Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Florida. I think he's got some real trouble in places like Virginia and Colorado, which are traditionally part of the Republican coalition. But if he wins Pennsylvania, I think that's what is the interesting thing kind of about the strategy in this election cycle. Pennsylvania's been fool's gold for Republicans for the last five or six cycles. They kind of get within two or three points. They can never get over the hump. There just hasn't seemed to be enough Republican votes in Pennsylvania to really make it a truly competitive state. And it's a pretty big prize. But if Pennsylvania really is within reach, and it seems to be a relatively good state for Trump, then the need, the absolute necessity of carrying states like Colorado and Virginia really diminishes. So I think he does have a path, but he has to have Florida, as Professor McDaniel said. Has to. There is no path that doesn't include Florida. There is a path that doesn't include Pennsylvania, but it puts a ton of pressure on him to carry states he's not carrying right now, Virginia and Colorado, right? I think he's kind of thematically issue basis better in Pennsylvania than he is in Virginia and Colorado. So it'll be interesting. But as I said, he's got to thread the needle. So I think the point is kind of, it carries. Even if, I think he does have a path, I think he's got one that is going to take it's a very difficult path. And that's doing something no Republican has done since George H.W. Bush in 1988. That's carry Pennsylvania. Right. So anyway, right, there you are. Things could change. But right now, looks like Clinton's got an edge, about 8 points in the national polls. Starts off with a stronger basis in the Electoral College, but we've been wrong so many times before, we've sort of given up on predicting these things, right?
Oh, yes, yeah. So, it's one of these things is to pay attention to, and compared to the key states and where they're spending their time. So understand there is a strategy associated with this. Now, going along with the 2016 election, there's been quite a bit about voter ID laws. So last week we talked about the Texas voter ID law being not necessarily struck down, but being asked to be rewritten in order for the 2016 election. However, North Carolina, we've actually seen the law being struck down for a very specific reason. Let's run that clip.
The court called it the most restrictive voting law North Carolina has seen since the era of Jim Crow, saying the law's provisions target African Americans with almost surgical precision. Attorney General Loretta Lynch was quick to hail the decision.
As the court found, this law was passed with discriminatory intent.
The legislature passed the law in 2013. North Carolina had emerged as a key swing state, with registration and turnout rates for African Americans in the state nearly equal to those of whites. It was one of 17 states with new restrictive voter laws in 2016, and the third gutted in the past 10 days. Republicans like North Carolina Representative David Lewis say the laws are necessary to combat voter fraud.
We just want to make sure that the people that go up to the polls to vote are in fact who they say they are.
Opponents like Allison Riggs of the Southern Coalition for Social Justice says North Carolina's efforts went far beyond those in other states.
This literally was a monster bill. It attacked every avenue of participation disproportionately used by voters of color.
The law required voters to show certain photo IDs that white voters were more likely to possess and eliminated other voter access tools like same-day registration and a full week of early voting that black voters relied on more heavily. For example, in 2012, 64% of African Americans voted early, compared to 49% of whites. Scaling back early voting effectively eliminated one Souls to the Polls Sunday, where African American churches provide transportation for voters.
Now, opponents say lifting these restrictions could increase turnout by hundreds of thousands of votes, and that could make a difference. In 2012, Mitt Romney beat President Obama by 2%. And in 2008, Scott, Mr. Obama beat John McCain by a razor-thin 0.3%.
Our chief legal correspondent, Jan Crawford, in the Washington newsroom. Jan, thanks so much.
All right, so we can see how we're seeing, again, the voter ID laws popped up, and there have been a lot of suits involving these, specifically the Justice Department. So the Obama administration, the Justice Department has been extremely active in these. And I think the one in North Carolina sticks out. So people have argued these are racially biased, but the one in North Carolina sticks out because that it seemed to be that many of the tools that African Americans were more likely to use for voting were the ones that were struck down, and so it seemed to be a racial intent there. Now again, people have said it may have been more partisan because blacks are more likely to support the Democratic Party. That's what they were really going after, but there does seem to be a strong racial intent. This is why the court said, you know, again, the most restrictive since Jim Crow.
Yeah, this is what's going to happen when you have a group that is 85-90% aligned with a particular party, which is, it's kind of hard to disentangle unless you have somebody on the floor of the legislature. By the way, this was also, the question of intent came up in the Texas voter ID case as well as in the North Carolina case, because in both instances, a Republican-controlled legislature instituted a voter ID law. And, you know, unless someone on the floor of the legislature is saying, I would like to disenfranchise African Americans, it's very hard to get intent. So there's sort of questions of, you know, in fact versus, you know, in theory, sorts of distinctions that the court raises. And the courts have basically said that, like, this question of intent, we don't need a smoking gun, we don't need a statement from some closed committee session where somebody says, I'd like to disenfranchise blacks. All we need is, you know, to demonstrate that there would be discriminatory, you know, the act itself would be discriminatory. There would be a disparate impact is the phrase that the court's always looking at. I mean, I'm sort of ambivalent on these things. I think the intent behind the voter ID stuff, I actually sort of believe it is kind of nakedly partisan. I think they're largely wedge issues that Republicans use because most voters, until recently, even African-American voters and Latino voters, you know, when asked a question of, do you think people should have to show a driver's license in order to vote on election day? Everybody said, sure, that's fine. But these laws have gotten a little cute. And I don't mean to minimize the issue because it's a very significant issue. But the laws are a little cute in that they do seem to, you know, require IDs that are disproportionately likely to be held by whites and less so by African-Americans or other racial and ethnic minorities. And that's where, you know, DOJ, the Justice Department, has gotten heavily involved in these things. I would say that the analysis provided by the CBS reporter there is probably not right. The analysis says that, well, you know, with this law being struck down, there's going to be, you know, lots of racial and ethnic minorities who didn't. 2012 was a record turnout in North Carolina. There was enormous. What had happened in 2012 was that the Democratic Party was using some of these restrictive laws and things to mobilize their voters, saying, hey, they're trying to disenfranchise you. Don't let them do that. And in fact, there was an increase in, you know, voting in places like Georgia and Indiana and then in North Carolina in the wake of some of these voter ID laws being passed. That's because they were used as effectively as by Democrats to counter-mobilize against what they saw as Republican efforts to disenfranchise racial and ethnic minorities. By the way, that's not a justification for doing them. I'm just a little skeptical about whether these voter ID laws have much of an impact on turnout. They could have a racially disparate impact, and that's all the court is considering. But as a matter of fact, they don't really seem to have much of an impact. And the reason, as y'all may have guessed, is the sorts of people who don't have IDs tend not to be voters. They should be, they should have the right to, but they don't tend to be voters. And that's something that's, you know, just kind of a fact. But again, that's not to be confused with an argument that these voter ID laws are right or that the court was wrong in their reasoning. So.
Yeah, I mean, again, one of the big problems with this voter ID fight is, one, people who are supportive of this say there's fraud, but it's very difficult to prove fraud. And those who are against them say, okay, it's going to disenfranchise, but it's very difficult to prove that it disenfranchises. And I mean, the thing about it is, I think in many ways these laws may have actually backfired. So even if it was an attempt to decrease the turnout for Democrats, well, basically what you've done is you've
given them an issue.
Yeah, you've given them an issue, you've given them a clear threat, so now people are turning out to vote. And so in many ways, I think this is backfiring. Now, again, if these laws stand for a long period of time, it may die down, but you know, it's a really interesting thing, but also, I mean, I like the idea of souls to the polls, of churches just taking busloads of people there. So, it seems pretty interesting. And also, given the work of Reverend William Barber and the statement of the DNC, you kind of see the work he's been doing in North Carolina, basically taking a national spotlight almost overnight.
Yeah. The other thing I'd mention is there's not a lot of evidence on this. And the reason it's hard to gauge the impact of voter ID is that, think about what you'd have to do from a research design. You'd have to do a survey of everybody, right, in the state. So let's say we want to study it in Texas. So we interview everybody in the state of Texas. Now we got to find people who didn't vote. So I asked, you know, Professor McDaniel, Professor Shaw, did you vote? And we say no. All right. And first of all, people are reluctant to say that, yes. Right? But so we find that. Those people. And then we say, okay, why didn't you vote? Right? Well, let's say you do a survey of 1,000 people. Right? Well, only 200 are going to say they didn't vote. Right? And of the 200 who didn't vote, how many are going to say, well, I didn't vote because of I didn't have the appropriate ID? Well, let's say 10. Right? Now, we're going to say, okay, well, three of them were black, and seven of them were, or five of them were white, and two of them were Hispanic. So our estimate is that, you know, that 30% of the non-voting, of the portion of the electorate was disenfranchised with voter ID is African American. Well, yeah, that's 3 out of 10. It's a power problem. Power in the sense that our studies are underpowered. It's what we call a classic low incidence event or a low rate event. And it's really hard to study things that aren't very common. You have to have massive surveys to get reasonable numbers of people to make estimates. And we're not even confident that the people we get are representative because, you know, again, you're talking about a population that can be extremely elderly, that can be homeless. I mean, these are the sorts of people that, you know, are not going to have ID, not exclusively, of course, but, you know, we're going to get very strong questions about how good our estimates are. But the other thing, though, that we have a few studies that are sort of interesting, and the one thing I'd like to point your attention to is that it says that in the first election, there is some evidence that there is a drop in the turnout rate once you have voter ID, that there's a drop in the turnout rate, but that people by the second and third and fourth elections learn and that dropout rate disappears. Again, not an argument for voter ID, but actually sort of made sense when I thought about it. I could definitely see going to the polls and forgetting my ID and not voting, but then the next election, you kind of learn how it is. So we don't have a lot of empirical evidence. That's the only stuff I've read, so take that for what you will. All right. So what we got? We got another issue, right?
One more issue going to the state level. So just again, focusing on policy. One of the things we saw.
Policy?
Happen, oh, yes. Yeah. We can only talk about Trump so much.
Dang it.
Massachusetts passed a pay equity law, and it sticks out from the others because of one particular aspect of it. We have a clip describing that.
Governor Baker just signed a bill that says, simply put, women and men who do the same work will get the same pay. The Massachusetts House and Senate unanimously approved the pay equity measure. Supporters say right now women earn about 82 cents for every dollar their male counterparts make.
This is a Commonwealth of Mass that in 1954 passed the first legislation around gender discrimination, and I think it's incredibly apt that we would be one of the first states in the country here today to pass legislation to ensure that people are paid what they are worth.
Now, this is a bill that also prevents employers from asking prospective workers for their salary history.
All right, so the Massachusetts bill really sticks out, not because of the discussion of pay equity. You've seen this going on with a number of states, but the key thing about it is that it bars companies from asking prospective employees how much they earned at previous jobs. So the argument here is that if the previous job took part in gender discrimination in terms of pay gap, it doesn't continue when you take your next take your next job. And so the argument here is that, well, women were paid less their low jobs, their first job, so they lowball them when they move to this next job. So the idea is if you're making, you know, $70,000 at this one job, men were making, let's say, $77,000. When you get to the new job, they ask you how much you're made. You're like, nope, I can't tell you that. Now, again, this law does not kick in for another couple years, but it's a way of trying to keep aspect of lower pay going. Now, also, what you see coming out of this law is companies cannot prohibit workers from disclosing a salary. So again, higher levels of transparency, and then equal pay for, it says fro, but for similar jobs. And
I like fro jobs.
Yeah, I guess I got a little Shakespearean when I was typing this up. Work that is of comparable character. So basically, the idea is if you're doing a job that's similar in terms of its workload, they want equal pay. And so what's really important to understand is there's been a lot of discussion about the pay gap between men and women, and there are a lot of variables that explain this in terms of work experience, occupational choices, things like that. However, they find even when you account for that, women are still paid less than men, and so there still seems to be something about gender, even when you control for work experience as well as occupational choice. But what this is part of a large effort by states to prevent the gender or prevent the gender pay gap or get rid of the gender pay gap. And so what's really important here is this is a great example of policy diffusion, specifically horizontal policy diffusion, where we're seeing states learning from other states. So Massachusetts is learning from states such as California in terms of how they wrote the law. Then they say, well, there seems to be a hole here, so let's fix this. And so this is clearly an example of states learning from other states. Now, again, this is horizontal policy diffusion. Now, whether or not this will become vertical policy diffusion will be interesting to see, because Massachusetts, again, is the state that gave you the kind of the archetype for the ACA, and to what degree that you might see the House and Senate, U.S. House and Senate, adopt some of these ideas from Massachusetts as well as from other states for national laws will be interesting as well. But it's, again, it's something that we'll see in the future, and it's an example of policy diffusion and how states are learning. Not only is it an example of advancing civil rights, but how states learn from other states in terms of how to advance the rights of particular groups that have historically been wronged.
Yep. Couple other things as we close for the week. Economic numbers released last Friday. The Bureau of Labor actually revised their economic forecasts for the second quarter. We typically, when we're thinking about both in terms of economic policy and then its relationship with presidential elections, focus on second quarter growth rates, second quarter before a presidential election. And just sort of ballpark, if you get about 2%, 2.1, 2.2% economic growth, that's sort of the cut point. An incumbent party seeking re-election. In this case, let's just name names. Hillary Clinton looking to be, you know, the third consecutive Democratic presidential victor, Obama twice, and then she's looking for a victory in 2016, that she needs a growth of about 2.2% in order to feel confident that voters will feel good enough about the economy to win. to re-elect her, essentially, re-elect her party. The growth rate was revised back into the ones. So interesting, even though the employment numbers have been very promising, at least the jobs numbers have been promising, you know, we've had job growth now for, I don't know how many hundreds of months, the growth numbers are a little forbidding and suggest basically this will be a very, very tight election. So that's one thing. Second thing, we're not going to talk about the Gold Star family controversy with Donald Trump, except to say it was interesting because Mr. Khan, in his speech before the Democratic National Convention, held up a copy of the Constitution and said that I don't think Donald Trump has read the Constitution. I just have two comments. One, I think that's probably right. Sorry, I just don't think he's actually read the Constitution. But secondly, there's actually nothing in the Constitution about immigration policy, per se. So while I thought the point was kind of really strong and emotional, and Donald Trump should stop arguing with families who have lost children in conflicts, I mean, Khan's larger point, which is it was actually really effective, Donald Trump, you have sacrificed nothing, you know, that's true compared to somebody like that. He says, stop arguing with people in that position. But there actually isn't anything in the Constitution on policy grounds that would sort of justify the particular comment that Trump hasn't read the Constitution. I think it's probably true for other reasons. And then third and finally today, I think Professor McDaniel, a little bit of mop-up work on the voting rights thing, on the voter ID case. Do you have another point you wanted to make on that?
Yeah, I mean, the central point for that is that while the CBS News report focused on the presidential elections, this is really important for local elections, state and local elections. If some of you are familiar with the Moral Mondays protest, this has really been this big pushback amongst progressives and using kind of religious language to push back against the Republican-controlled legislature. And they said that Republicans kind of swept in and made a lot of changes. And so what this may actually do is change the structure of the legislature. It may not change who the governor is, but may change the structure of the legislature and may change things in local level elections. And this is where you're seeing a lot of attention being paid. Specifically in regards to a number of movements of trying to have some local control to provide some equity there. But again, these are things that we'll talk about more as we continue. But this is all we have for today, and we wish you a good week.
All right. Stay cool.
The Government 310 in the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government and the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.